This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play Music, Reason.com, or anywhere else you like to listen to podcasts, and rate and review us while you're there. We are at Freedom Fest, the world's largest annual gathering of libertarians, held every July in Las Vegas. This year it's at the Paris Hotel, and I'm sitting across from Randy Barnett, Libertarian Legal Eagle, and we're going to talk about Brett Kavanaugh and the Supreme Court more broadly. Randy, thanks for saying hello.
Always good to see you at Freedom Fest.
All right.
Not at any other place, but only at Freedom Fest.
I get that completely. I feel the same way, and I only wish that we were, staying in totally separate cities. But so Brett Kavanaugh, the problems I have with him start with the fact that he's a man, but he spells his name with two T's. That seems strange. And Kavanaugh with a K. I don't know.
I think you and Stephen Colbert share this concern.
Oh, was that one of his?
Well, okay, yeah. He didn't like the name Brett for some reason.
Brett, if it's B-R-E-T, but Brett, B-R-E-T-T, seems like that's the woman's version.
This seems to be the most serious objection Colbert has so far.
Yeah. Well, what about you? I mean, there seems to be no question, that Kavanaugh is qualified in terms of he's already a D.C. Circuit Court judge. He has a law degree. He has a track record. He's not an insane person. He's not Harriet Myers or Donald Trump's sister. What is your sense? Is he not just qualified for this, but is he a good pick from a libertarian perspective?
Well, there's three things I look for in a justice. The first is a demonstrated track record commitment to originalism, which is the idea that the meaning of the Constitution remains the same until it's properly changed. The second is some commitment or some demonstrated willingness to enforce that against the popular branches by invalidating laws that are in conflict with the Constitution, not bending over backwards to uphold those laws. And then the third one is whether they're prepared to defend what we might call unenumerated rights, protect unenumerated rights, not directly by saying, here's the rights you have, but by enforcing the due process of law clause, which says that arbitrary exercise of government power is beyond the power of legislatures to enact, and courts should be in the business of figuring out whether a law is arbitrary or not. Those are three things I look for. So let me just say that when it comes to the judges on the list of 25 that Trump could have picked from, there are very, very few, if any, I would think there are actually a couple, who might go for number three. Okay. So with respect to the kind of judges we're likely to get out of any Republican administration, the best we can hope for is one and two. And really, Judge Gorsuch set the standard for one and two. He had a demonstrated commitment to the original public meaning of the text. There's no question, I think, that he has the intestinal fortitude to enforce that meaning against the majoritarian branches. And so that should be the standard going forward.
But there's who on the list hits your number three? Who gets all the way to third base?
Well, I think, for example, Don Willett might get there.
Yeah. Mike Lee?
Probably not.
Yeah.
Very few. I mean, we don't know with a lot of them. I don't know about a lot of them, frankly. But when I don't know, I sort of assume the negative.
Right.
I think Clint Bollock, was he on the list? I can't remember if he's on the list or not.
He would get there.
I think he'd get there. Yeah. Right. But it's moot because none of those folks were even on the short list this time.
Right.
So of the other people that were the alternatives to Kavanaugh, none of them were going to be any better than Kavanaugh on this regard. And I don't know that, Justice Gorsuch is going to be particularly good in this respect. But I think he was a home run on number one and two. So now the question is, how did Kavanaugh shape up on one and two? I'm trying to be realistic now.
Yeah.
And he seems to be an originalist. He doesn't like to use the term originalism, which bothers me, because I think by now you ought to use it.
And because you're getting like a royalty, you get a nickel every time somebody calls themselves an originalist.
TM. Yes, you have to put the TM after it.
Yeah.
Or R, is it R with a circle around it?
Yeah. I know.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
So,
By the way, when you're asking a guy with a PhD in English whether it's the R with a circle or the TM and you're the law professor, something has gone horribly
wrong.
Yeah,
but you have an interest in literary property that I might not
share. I think, these ideas are all out there in the air and we should just grab them and use them. You can't dissect Gossamer.
I'm actually for that. But anyway, so he doesn't use the term originalism. He has, in one opinion, said the way to interpret the Constitution is according to its original meaning. So that's actually what originalism is. But that's one out of 300 opinions when he's given speeches. He calls himself a textualist. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Originalism is a kind of textualism. Right. But I'd like to see more questioning of him on this basis. I'd have to believe that by now he is, but I would not necessarily take it for granted. On the issue of being not bending over backwards to uphold laws that are unconstitutional, he did, in fact, bend over backwards in another Obamacare case, which I was actually present during oral argument when he was when it was before his panel. He did bend over backwards to get out from under deciding that case. And ultimately, in his both in oral argument and in his opinion, he instructed the legislature on how they could just tweak the law to make it constitutional under the tax power.
Is that ever a good thing for a judge to be doing? Because I'm thinking about, you know, with the case that ultimately gave rise to the net neutrality or the open Internet order under Tom Wheeler, Obama's head of the FCC. The judge, when saying like, yeah, you know, FCC, you don't have jurisdiction over the Internet, but if you do this, that, and the other thing, you know, you can pull it off. I mean, is that always a bad thing? Like, why should the judge be telling government how to get its job done?
Republicans have been telling us for decades they don't want judges who legislate from the bench. Mm. This is almost the definition of legislating from the bench. I mean, it's not because their advice is not law. But they're telling legislatures how to legislate, and they're doing it from the bench. So I think that if it's bad for – I don't like the legislate from the bench metaphor, but if that's a bad thing, this is what they seem to be doing.
What are – when you, so you laid out a kind of three issues or three concerns that you have when you're evaluating a Supreme Court justice. How do you get to – like assuming, okay, you've got a person and, you know, by most accounts I've read – and I will openly admit that I don't fully understand or appreciate it, but that Kavanaugh is really bad when it comes to certain kinds of Fourth Amendment issues or giving, you know, whether it's the NSA or other state surveillance agencies, just broad, you know, purview to do whatever they want. How do you weigh something like that versus, say, other people will say Kavanaugh is really good about the administrative state and about saying, no, you know what, like, you got to go back to Congress and get an actual, you know, law that says this is what you're supposed to be doing. How do you kind of equilibrate all of these things?
I don't know. I don't think there is no magic formula.
Right. No, well, I'm asking you, he's super bad on Fourth Amendment stuff and he's really great on the others, so it's okay, or he sucks on this or that.
I suppose it might depend on where the baseline is. So if he's bad, but the baseline's bad, he doesn't ultimately make anything worse. But if the baseline's bad and he's better, then all things being equal, he's better because, say, the baseline's bad on the administrative state, but he's better on the administrative state. So that'll move it in a positive direction, whereas the other one isn't actually going to move it in a negative direction because it's already pretty terrible.
But I
don't even know if that applies to Judge Kavanaugh's Fourth Amendment stuff.
Right.
But that's one way to look at how you decide these incommensurable things.
Yeah. So I'm getting a sense that particularly if it had been, if it had been Kavanaugh first and then Gorsuch, you would be more at ease. The fact that Gorsuch seems to be a better version of Kavanaugh.
Oh, Gorsuch was a great pick.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not a better version of Kavanaugh.
Okay.
The question is is Kavanaugh going to be more like John Roberts?
John Roberts is pretty much, he's your supervillain, right? He's your Magneto. At this point, he's bad, right?
He has shown us what the wages of urging judicial what conservatives have been urging judicial restraints our whole life, and he shows us what happens when you get what you wish for, and it's not so good.
And by that, I mean particularly with something like Obamacare, you get what you would argue, I assume, is actually an unconstitutional law or a badly written law that should not have legal force.
Yeah.
And Roberts didn't just fall asleep and rubber stamp it, but he actively went out of his way to kind of come up with a rationale.
He basically adopted what he calls a saving construction, which he says is not the natural meaning of the statute, but it was a reasonably possible reading of the statute. And if he could find a reasonably possible reading of the statute that was constitutional, he had a duty to defer to the statute. That's actually his actual words. Duty to defer to the statute. Not defer to Congress, he said.
Right.
Defer to the statute. It might have been a misplaced word. And uphold the statute. And frankly, This is very similar to what Judge Kavanaugh did on the, you know, on the D.C. Circuit. He went out of his way to say this is very close to being a tax, and all it would have to do, and maybe it is, but he's not going to say one way or the other, but all they'd have to do is tweak this little thing and it would be a tax. And that's very close to what John Roberts did. So now we're not arguing now about whether he's more or less like he's going to be another Kennedy, mm-hmm. which actually, you know, Justice Kennedy would reach libertarian friendly results, even if he was not an originalist, because he had a kind of a core interest in liberty. Right. That's why the Supreme Court as a whole, with Kennedy as the fifth vote, did reach some libertarian results. They didn't do so on originalist grounds. I wish they would have.
So part of what your calculation, or I guess what your analysis is also then, so Kennedy's gone, and if Kavanaugh moves on to the court, then does that make John Roberts the true kingmaker, or does Kavanaugh become the kingmaker? Or but more to the point, this is kind of changing the mix of the meal here, and I suspect that you're not happy about, if you have Roberts and Kavanaugh, that's going to create a different set of problems than if you have...
First of all, I'm not 100% sure about Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. I'm just giving you what right. I think or suspect based on what I know, and yeah. Nobody knows for sure. I'll be very interested in how these hearings go. The basic point I thought you were going to make, which I think people ought to know, and that is that where Kennedy was the median vote, and so everybody was addressed to Kennedy, whether he would go one way or the other, and because he had an interest in liberty, he would oftentimes go mm-hmm. the liberty outcome. Now it's Roberts is likely to be the median vote. I mean, I think Kavanaugh is going to be to the right of Roberts, and whether he's going to be like Alito or whether he's going to be like Gorsuch, I would love for him to be like Gorsuch. In fact, this fun fact, he and Gorsuch both clerked for Kennedy the same year. Hmm. They're co-clerks.
And they went to high school together.
And
let me ask you this slightly below the level that we've been talking at, but is it at all?
I know this is the level you prefer, but
yes. So the lower we can get, we can get underground. Then we're getting warm,
right?
But you know, so they both grew up large periods of time in like Chevy Chase, Bethesda, Maryland. They both went to Yale at some point or whatever. I mean, all of the Supreme Court justices basically have now gone to Harvard or Yale.
I mean, that's just fair to suggest Judge Gorsuch. Justice Gorsuch, he's a Colorado and his family's from Colorado.
Yeah, but he went to high school.
But his mom was Ann Gorsuch.
Part of the swamp. Yeah, she was the head of the EPA.
Yeah,
until she got bounced for some funny business.
I don't know how funny it was.
Okay. Well, she didn't serve out her term. What I'm getting at, is there a case to be made for geographical diversity or educational diversity of, I mean, if everybody goes to Harvard and Yale, I mean, it's kind of great that, Columbia gets squeezed out, but like, what about Stanford? What about University of Washington? What about somebody from University of New Mexico?
Look, Amy Barrett mm-hmm. Went to Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And she teaches at Notre Dame. She went to Notre Dame. I like that about her, but on the other hand, I'm not sure you'd like Amy Barrett.
Oh, yeah. No. My sister is actually a dean at Notre Dame, and I'm kind of on the fence about her. She's not a lawyer, but Judge Napolitano went to Notre Dame, so I love to see them lose in football. But I know what you mean. Like, I wouldn't want somebody from Notre Dame, but is there an argument to be made for...
Well, let me... I just say the interest in this podcast is don't have... there's lots of good people at Notre Dame, and many of them would make great justices.
Yeah.
And so that's my view about Notre Dame.
Joe Montana would have made a former quarterback for Notre Dame. Would have been great. But, no, what I'm just asking the question, not about Notre Dame or anything. Is there a problem with just too many people having too many similar experiences being on the Supreme Court, even as the Supreme Court now looks more like America than it probably ever has, in terms of kind of racial, gender, ethnic diversity? But, I mean, like, if you all go to the same schools and, you're hanging out, you're clerking for the same former Supreme Court justice, et cetera, are we shrinking the gene pool?
Well, I don't think that's as big an issue as the fact that they all have to be federal court of appeals judges mm-hmm. before they get put on the court, because anybody who gets to be a federal court of appeals judge has to fit a certain template, and then they have to be willing to do that, and then they have to, which is, I think, it's a deadly dull job, I think that creates more homogeneity.
I see.
Than where they went to law school,
right, or even where they were raised,
Where they were raised.
Yeah.
I mean. Because, in fact, there is an elite everywhere you are, and, in fact, most law school educations are more similar than different. You don't get a different, you get a slightly more left-wing education at Stanford, perhaps, than you do at other places, but, you know, they're all basically the same, all the law schools are. So I don't think that tells us that much.
What, before Supreme Court justices, or how long have Supreme Court justices always been judges, as opposed to, you know, just... either, you know, significant donors, people with blackmail on presidents, or interesting legal theorists, or former presidents like, you know, William Howard Taft.
This has been an increasing trend. I'm not sure it's great. The reason why you see it on the right is that there people want a judge with a track record because they don't want to get burned. This is the getting burned by Souter, getting burned by Stevens. So they want to avoid the stealth candidate, so they want somebody with a long judicial record. Some of the people on Trump's short list this time didn't have a very long judicial record, including Amy Barrett. She hadn't been on the court very long. And that gave people pause because they want to see this record so that they know this person has a long... And I agree. We do want a person with a longstanding commitment to originalism and the role of judges. Amy Barrett, for example, has written some great originalist scholarship. On the other hand, she also wrote an article about why my book, Our Republican Constitution, is wrong on the role of judges.
So can you get see past that? Or are you like, I guess the question that I'm asking is...
I can see past that, by the way.
When you are saying like, okay, I think this person is it qualified or would be a good pick, et cetera, I mean... You know, people talk about, do they have the right temperament? Do they have the right this? Is this all like a roundabout way of just bullshitting and saying, no, what I want are justices who would resolve cases the way that I would?
See, that's the legal realist way of looking at judges, which I object to, and you see it on the left and you see it on the right. The Roe versus Wade pro, the Roe versus Wade con, and I think this is the wrong way to do it. I think we need judges who... approach the Constitution in a certain way, and then that gives them results. For example, we just had this cell tower case, this Carpenter case. I didn't follow the case that closely. I did not have a rooting interest. I'm generally very pro-privacy. I'm against the surveillance state.
I mean, just to flesh it out a little bit more, this was whether or not police or surveillance people needed warrants to decide whether or not they could follow where your cell phone...
Well, whether they could get the records... of the locations that were available from cell towers. Right. Cell tower location records that the cell companies have.
Right.
Now, can they get those records without a warrant, or do they just need a subpoena? That's the issue. Okay. Now, I'm very pro-privacy. I'm very skeptical about all the surveillance state. There's certain Supreme Court decisions I'd like to see reversed that would make things more protective, and Justice Gorsuch, I think, also shares that view. But with respect to that particular case, my way of approaching is I want to hear what the Constitution says first. That will help me know whether cell tower data, location data, actually should be gotten by a warrant or not. Not do I like the idea of them getting it, and then I'm going to find a constitutional reason why they ought to get it.
How do you do that, though? Because the Constitution was written at least 5 years before cell phones were
a thing. Justice Thomas, in his dissenting opinion in that case, for example, said, look, the Fourth Amendment talks about securing people in their persons, papers, houses, and effect. The cell tower data is not theirs. Whether it's a good idea or a bad idea.
And this is not even necessary. I mean, or it doesn't qualify as a third party.
Well, the third party thing is another thing, a doctrine I disagree with.
Okay.
And Justice Gorsuch, in his dissenting opinion, outlined a way that third party data is protectable if, in fact, it's still yours, but you sort of consign it to a company. Just because you bail it out, it's a bailment to another company. Just because you house your email in a company's server doesn't mean it's not your email anymore. And so that's the roadmap he's following to say why, in fact, a property approach would be more protective under the Fourth Amendment. But with respect to cell tower data, we don't know if that would apply that or not. I guess the only point I'm saying is that I try not to make up my mind first about the outcome I want and then come up with whatever justification will get me there. I'd like to let the Constitution lead me there, if possible.
So,
in order for me to know how the case should be decided, on policy grounds, you might want a law passed that would be more protective of privacy than the Constitution would mandate. Mm-hmm. But in terms of how a case should be decided, I'd like to figure that out from the text of the Constitution, if possible.
And so is that how you decide whether or not you're like, okay, this, you know, I may or may not agree with somebody, but yeah, they're a legitimate candidate who should be approved or confirmed.
Yes, because if they're actually going to do that in good faith, look at what the Constitution mm-hmm. requires. And because I think we have a good Constitution, not a perfect one, but better than the Constitution the Supreme Court has given us, if they'll do that, I think we're better off, even if I disagree with them politically.
What are the types of things that would come out in confirmation hearings that would legitimately just be like, okay, Kavanaugh, hit the road? I mean, this is a guy who, I mean, he's already been approved and confirmed by the Senate in his current job.
Right.
So, I mean, but, you know, it's stuff about how much money did he spend on Washington Nationals tickets, things like that. I mean, what is the type, and not specific to him, but what are the types of things that might come out that would really be like, even his supporters would have to be like, yeah, we kind of screwed up.
If he tells me that the text and history are just two things to be taken into account when deciding how to decide a case, that would be very bothersome, because that's exactly what the living constitutionalists say. Mm-hmm. So yeah, text is important. They don't deny that. And history is important too. They don't deny that. But that's not the only thing that's important. And so we got to take into account other things. If he were to say something like that, which I don't think he will say, then that would be a deal breaker for me.
Are Supreme Court nomination hearings or confirmation hearings, are they... Are they just theater, or have they been? I mean, I can remember the Bork hearings, and I can remember Clarence Thomas's hearings. And, you know, they were kind of riveting. This was all before Keeping Up with the Kardashians and whatnot, so we didn't have high standards for reality TV. But this was, you know, incredibly raw, powerful drama. And I can remember, with Bork, I guess I was reading Reason. I wasn't involved in political journalism or anything. And I have been led to believe by the, you know, public accounts that this guy was pure evil. And in many ways, I think he was, or certainly he was, whatever his writings after his failed Supreme Court nomination, he was pretty creepy as far as I'm concerned in terms of free speech and whatnot. But when I saw him, I was like, holy shit, this guy is like really fucking smart. He's sharp. He's interesting. He could be funny. You know, it was really powerful stuff. What should we be looking for in Supreme Court confirmation hearings beyond just theater?
Well, this is a big topic. Josh Blackman of South Texas Law School and I wrote an article in 2016 called Restoring the Lost Confirmation. Mm. It's a takeoff on
you
my book.
You are really just doing brand extensions.
Yes,
yeah.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Right. Yeah. So, and we talked about how we got to where we are in these confirmation hearings. I urge people to check out Google Restoring the Lost Confirmation, mm-hmm. and our article on the national interest will pop up. It's a long article. Mm-hmm. But it tells you the history of confirmation hearings and how we got where we are, how we got to the point where there's a catechism that all the judges, Democrat and Republican, use to avoid answering any questions, and what questions they should be asked to try to get around that. Mm-hmm. And we argue, to simplify our argument, is that you should be asking about clauses, not cases. That what both Republicans and Democrats are interested in is what you said you were interested in a few minutes ago, is the results of cases.
Right.
So they all want to try to find out, how are you going to decide this case? And the judges don't want to say, because it's going to piss off one side or the other. So they want to avoid that, and they've got ways to do it now that are very, very effective. So you have to stop asking about cases and start asking about clauses. What do you think the Privileges or Immunities Clause means? Mm-hmm. What do you think the Commerce Clause means? How do you think you should figure out what it means? And I'll tell you, if senators and their knowledgeable staff drafted questions that were like that, you'd learn a lot. And first of all, you might learn that this particular nominee doesn't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. You'd have to have one failed nominee who couldn't answer all these questions. Hmm. And then people say, well, I can't vote for this guy. He doesn't know the Constitution. And then after that, they'll all prep themselves on it. And then lower court judges who want to be Supreme Court judges, they'll start writing opinions and they'll start prepping themselves. And it will change the practice of law in this country if senators would start asking questions about clauses and not cases.
Well, of course that's not going to happen then, right? Because that would mean that the Senate would have to do their jobs or part of their jobs. And if they're not going to pass budgets and spending bills, why would they do this?
I'm as cynical as you are, so it's hard for me to answer this question straight, with a straight face. But I will say there are members of the Judiciary Committee, and that's what matters, who actually are interested in the Constitution. Mike Lee is interested in the Constitution. Ted Cruz is interested in the Constitution. Ben Sasse is interested in the Constitution. And all three of them, I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody else.
Yeah, right.
They're all, the three of them are very smart.
Mm-hmm.
They are capable of asking real questions. Up until recently, the senators on the Judiciary Committee were not capable of asking real questions. Back in the Bork hearings, they were more capable. They haven't been for some time now. We have a few on there that could, and it wouldn't take many of them to turn these hearings into a substantive direction.
A lot of the critics, and it's not to call them critics of Kavanaugh isn't even right. I mean, they're just anti-Trump people in the press or politicians and whatnot. They're particularly concerned about, Donald Trump, and he campaigned like every Republican presidential candidate on overturning. He's going to appoint judges. Literally, he said, I'm going to appoint judges who will overturn Roe versus Wade. Is that even possible? And if it is it a wise thing?
First of all, one thing that happened this time, which I think was so healthy, and I would like it happened every single time from now on, let every candidate put a list of judges that they would consider. Let them all create their list of 25. That would be fantastic. I want the Democrats to do it.
Yeah, because it does really tell you a lot about the thinking of the person, who they reach for expertise.
Yes, exactly.
And it's clear that came about because Trump, there were a lot of Republicans who were like, how the hell did we end up with this guy? And is he serious?
This is part of how we did end up with him.
Right.
Because before that happened, he had to prove that he was actually with the program.
Right.
And this is how he proved
right.
it. By putting out a list.
Right.
And then, some of us were skeptical that he'd keep to the list. But he did keep to the list. In fact, he only promised to use the list the first time. Mm-hmm. Then we were skeptical he'd ever use it a second time. But he did use it a second time. Mm-hmm. Let them all do that now. So that's really, really good. What was the question? I forgot the question.
Is it possible for the court to, or for Trump to appoint judges who will overturn Roe versus Wade? And if they can do that, is that a wise decision?
Well, first of all, on the Roe issue, just remember now that the median vote on the court has gone from Justice Kennedy, and it's probably now Justice Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
So with respect to the particular issue of whether the court is actually going to do this, it'll depend on what Justice Roberts wants to see done. And I'd be very surprised if he wants to see Roe versus Wade revisited directly. And Ilya Shapiro and I were just on a program here in which he said this, and I agree with him, is that you're going to see more regulations of abortion practices upheld as we go forward.
Is that...
But not a denial of the right to abortion.
To an abortion in the first trimester, basically.
Right.
Which is essentially what Roe made.
Right. Well, Roe isn't the law anymore anyway. Planned Parenthood versus Casey supplanted Roe, even though we like to talk about Roe.
But it did draw on that, and it did not change. That's the core finding, right?
It threw the trimester system out.
Okay.
It did. I mean, now it was supposedly, it was like not in Casey at all.
Okay.
And so it's about viability outside the womb. And that actually will vary depending on technology.
Right. How do you feel about, are you pro-choice or pro-life?
I'm generally pro-choice.
Yeah. So, and again, we're not talking about, so that's the outcome. Now, how do we get there? I'm just, that's a separate issue. But how, I think a lot about the kind of evacuation of faith and confidence and trust in institutions. And with something like, abortion rights, we now have conservative Republicans who are trying to nickel and dime and regulate businesses, to death. I mean, that's what they do in places like Texas and Virginia, where they say, we're not going after your right to have an abortion, but that abortion clinic has to be a hospital, or it has to be adjacent to a hospital. It has to have these kinds of guardrails. It has to have these corridors that allow this. You have to have, this and that. I mean, and it's exactly the type of shit that Republicans 20 years ago were bitching and moaning about Democrats doing to local delicatessens or something.
Well, they weren't bitching very hard about that, frankly, Nick.
Okay, so.
But this goes to the third criteria that I said judges should have, and that is looking to try to identify arbitrary laws where the legislatures are really trying to do one thing, but they say they're doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to actually help out their buddies, or in this case, they're trying to suppress abortions. But that's what they want to do. But what they say they're doing is health and safety regulations. Right. And what I think and Damon Root on Reason is somebody who's a big proponent of this. He's going to be doing some nice vetting of Judge Kavanaugh. He already started. He's going to do some more on this issue. I think judges should be trying to smoke out pretextual justifications for regulations, whether it's about abortion or anything else. And the only time they do it under current law is if it's a fundamental right. And the right to abortion has now been deemed a fundamental right under the right of privacy, or if it's a protected class. If you have a protected class or a fundamental right, then judges will be suspicious and skeptical and try to smoke out pretexts. My approach, that principle number three I look for, that I don't find on very many of the lists of 25, but I wouldn't find them on the Democrats' list either, is to smoke out pretext across the board.
Right.
And then smoke out pretext with respect to abortion regulations, but also smoke out pretext with respect to other things as well.
Yeah. Amy Barrett, at Notre Dame, so not surprising. I assume she's a football fan, but I do know for sure she's Catholic. Dianne Feinstein, in a previous confirmation hearing for her, was talking like out of something out of The Handmaid's Tale, really, where she's like, the dogma is strong in you and all of this. Having said all of that, is that a legitimate question? You know, is the religious disposition of a justice who is going to rule on issues that are clearly contrary to the dogma of their church, is that like a legitimate topic of discussion in confirmation?
Well, Amy's already she's written about that, just so you know. And she said that, you know, if that judges should not follow their religious precepts if it's at odds with the Constitution. If they really can't do something in good conscience, they should recuse themselves and not decide the case at all. That's what she said. I think it's only an issue if you believe that someone is going to put their religious values above that of the Constitution or the statute they're asked to enforce. And to assume that Catholics will do that and not other people will do that, that's a form of anti-Catholic bigotry.
Right. So, I mean, it's really no different. What I just said is no different than when Trump talked about the judge in Indiana who was Mexican-American. And so,
it's the
of
same
course,
thing.
He would only, And look at me. I'm a lapsed Catholic. So I'm going to have to go to confession now. This has become very confusing for me to expiate the sin of being anti-Catholic. What is your guess of, Kavanaugh, will he be approved? Will he be, by the Senate?
The odds always would favor it. If you were betting here in Vegas, we're in Vegas now.
Is there a line on this? I don't
can
know.
We go?
Is it legal to bet on judicial appointments?
The Supreme Court betting bar, sports betting bar, right? I would say, the odds are great that he's going to be approved. But look, he has a huge long record or employment history in D.C. He was on the Starr investigation.
Yeah. Should that concern us? I mean, by some accounts, he was one of the principal authors of the Starr, report.
I don't know. I've heard that. And he also was the secretary to the president, President Bush, in the sense that he was managing the flow of information that went to the president. So there's a lot of paperwork that now the Justice Department is now under enormous burden to vet all the paperwork to know what can be turned over and what can't be turned over because of executive privilege and everything else. And who knows? Believe me, you do not know. Right now they're complaining about his first name is Brett.
Yeah.
My prediction is that's not what they're going to be complaining about a month from now or 2 months from now when they start getting their hands on emails and other documents that they're going to get.
How do you feel about the claims, and obviously it's all impotential now, so we don't know, but, claims of executive privilege. Like, the guy's gone up for the Supreme Court, but like, no, we can't let you see that because that would violate executive privilege.
Look, I think it's really difficult if you work in government to not be able to express yourself in writing because someday that writing is either going to be available under the Freedom of Information Act or it's going to be available under these situations. That act, I don't know, let me just tell you, Nick, people in high ends of government, they don't communicate in writing anymore.
Thankfully, would Kavanaugh be okay with us getting on the hands of the NSA tapes that he doesn't seem to bother, that don't bother him in terms of mass surveillance?
I just don't think it's necessarily healthy that government officials can't communicate in writing.
Is there, what are the ways
because
to
Because that's
reset
how we
that?
Communicate.
Yeah, is, and that's like the beauty, among the many things that are beautiful about the Constitution is that it's written down and we can all refer to it. What is the way to reset that? Or is there a way to reset that? And I think this is in other conversations we've had. You know, one of my kind of hobby horses or passions and obsessions is, you know, we are at historically low levels of trust and confidence, certainly in the government, in many other aspects of our society. Like, we need some kind of reboot where people feel more comfortable about big business, about the Supreme Court, about the presidency, about the Congress. How do we reboot these types of things?
I don't think we're at a stage at the moment where we can think about rebooting. We have, I think we have a culture war going on. I think it's very real. There are two Americas in this respect. Neither side wants to lay down in the path of the other. I would say the only way we could ever segue into this is if we were to restore constitutional federalism again, where people would be more content to effectuate their social policies at the state and local levels and allow people to gravitate to the states they like better than the states that they don't like, and not resolve everything at the federal level. But as long as the federal government has this much power over everything that we do, and there's a clash in the culture between when there was a hegemonic rule by one party, this was not a problem. But as soon as there's a clash between left and right, and now the bases of each party are becoming more entrenched and maybe more extreme.
As they get smaller, but they're dead enders now. So they're like, you know, fewer people call themselves Republican or Democrat than 20 or 30 years ago. Those people, they are the remnants, right? They're going to fight to the last man.
And here's why people fight. People fight to get their way, but they also fight to not have the way of the other person imposed upon them. That's the thing they even like. They hate that more than even not getting their way. They just don't want to have to live under the other guy's rule.
And so it's the flip. I think it's attributed to Genghis Khan. It's kind of the, not that it's not enough for me to win, but my enemy must lose. It's like, it's not enough for me to lose. My enemy must not win.
Yeah, I guess.
I'm not sure that. Just nod, and we could get out of this.
I'm not sure that helps us any.
I think Genghis Khan, you know, we should be looking to him for more illumination of contemporary America.
Let me just restate the point, because I think at this point your listeners forgot what I was saying. It's like, there's the benefit of having your policy adopted, but there's also the cost of living under your opponent's policy. And the second thing is sometimes more onerous, and people will fight to the death to not have that happen to them. And as everything is escalated to the federal government, everything's a winner-take-all game, then everything's a fight. And we're not going to reboot until we actually start to decentralize decision-making to the state level. We have 50 of them, and then in turn down to more municipal decisions. But that's the path forward. Federalism, unfortunately, I know it sounds like a cliche, but I think federalism is our most practical step forward under our constitutional structure. We're lucky we have a system that still has 50 states, because we can put, if you had to invent 50 states now, you'd never do it. But we have them already. So now we have a system in which the written constitution allows for this to happen, enforce the written constitution, have more decisions decided at the local level, and that's going to take the pressure off of this culture war that we're on.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much.
My Randy pleasure. Barnett. Thanks for having me.
Randy Barnett of Georgetown Law, and the author of many books, and at least one story that you told us to Google, which we certainly will, about the lost confirmation.
Yeah, restoring the lost confirmation with me and Josh Blackman.
That sounds great. This has been The Reason Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play Music, Reason.com, or anywhere you like to get your podcast on, and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.